1276 United States versus Inova. Hello. How are you, Mr. Carlson?
I'm well, Judge. How are you?
Good morning, I know.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm court-appointed counsel for Desmond Inova in this case, and I want the court to understand I did not represent Mr. Inova before the district court. The arguments that I am making here as far as the sophisticated means enhancement as well as the abusive position of trust enhancement are very similar. And instead of repeating each of the arguments, I'll address all of the factors that I raise with respect to both of them because they are the same. But I'll do it with the sophisticated means enhancement as the tool to do that. And I would point out first of all, that the pre-sentence report in this case did not recommend that there be an adjustment for sophisticated means. And the probation department found that the instant offense was not any more complex or intricate than necessary to accomplish the normal kind of fraud of this nature. And that while the defendant did engage in multiple misrepresentations and lies, said lies were part of a normal part of a fraud of this nature. And I think that that is very important because it is the government who bears the burden of establishing that a sophisticated means enhancement should apply. And quite frankly, the government presented no evidence as to what level of planning or concealment is involved in a typical fraud of this case.
Was there an objection below to the court's use of information that was gleaned from other sentencing hearings to
there was no objection.
So our review of that issue is for plain error.
That's correct, Judge, and there's no question that was not objected to below. But again, as I said, the government offered nothing to establish that the number of individuals involved in this case or the number of documents or the types of documents involved in this case made this any different than the typical fraud case of this kind. And what I think is important to note is not only did they not do that, but when they sought to justify application of this enhancement, they relied on unsworn statements from the assistant United States attorney who was handling the case from the change of plea hearing. And they did that.
Can a district court judge who's deeply familiar with the facts of a case, however the judge got there. This was a plea, as I recall, right?
Yes.
But she had these other cases, and so by the time she gets to Mr. Anabaugh, she knows the facts of the case, right?
I would agree with Your Honor.
Okay. So can we say that the district court judge is entitled to look at the inherent facts in the case without the full sort of evidentiary presentation that might otherwise be desirable, perhaps necessary, in a case where the judge is considering the facts of the case for the first time?
I think in certain circumstances that could very well be true. But here what happened was after the United States attorney, in this case, made some of these comments at the change of plea hearing, the defendant said, I strongly disagree with that, calling to the court's attention that some of the factors that are unique to this case, which were not necessarily even involved in the other case, the other cases involved in this. So we're now having new material before the district court judge. And even assuming that those matters were brought to the judge's attention, there's nothing here to show how those facts are in any way different than the typical fraud case of this kind. Just because the co-defendants in the same scheme, they may have been typical to that, it's still the same scheme. It's not the typical scheme of this kind. And I noted that even in one of the cases that the government cited, the Whalen case, the government in that case actually called the agent who was involved in the investigation of the case to testify as to what is involved in a typical fraud of the kind involved in that case and what was involved here. And based upon that, they presented the evidence and the judge was able to make a finding. That didn't happen here. At best, what we had is on a occasion where the district court judge asked the prosecutor whether certain things were true despite the defendant having said otherwise, and the defendant, the assistant United States attorney saying, yes, I think so. And those, based on that evidence, the judge made findings. And I think that with respect to this case, especially with in a situation where the government could have presented evidence as to what the typical fraud case is, could have presented evidence as to why this case was different from the typical fraud case of this kind, they didn't do that. And the district court didn't make those kinds of findings either. And she couldn't have because the government presented no evidence to that. So I think.
But why would it be reasonable to infer that because of the length of employment and the type of employment, we don't have enough here? He's not a simple clerk. He's a mortgage broker making more than $100,000 annually in commissions. He worked for the employer for over 8 years. You've got a lot happening. You know, a lot of stuff here.
And could I just supplement what Judge Rovner has mentioned as those inherent facts, which is sort of what I was trying to grapple with in the abstract. But one other one is that he signed a document that represented to the employer that he interviewed the loan applicants. You don't dispute that?
We do not.
And he was a licensed loan originator, as Judge Rovner said, which meant that he wasn't an independent broker or loan originator. He worked for this employer at an elevated status, that he had more responsibilities in addition to his tenure. And that the employer, I do believe that Judge Kendall asked the government, or at least she put the question out there, did the employer rely on this man's representations about these loans? And the AUSA said something in the affirmative. Yes. Isn't that true?
Yes, and I will point out to the court's attention that Judge Kendall asked the prosecutor about what is a license of loan or injury that is of this type of the information AFC relied on in determining whether Mason was a suitable risk, and if that's the case, then I think you have a position of trust. Is that the case? And then without any evidence supporting that, he says, I believe so. And then right after that, the judge then makes the finding that the employer relied solely on that information. There's nothing there to support Judge Kendall's determination that other than the prosecutor's unsworn statement, yes, I believe so.
And her knowledge of everything else that had gone on.
But that issue had not been an issue in, as far as we can tell, in any of the other sentencings, because those people weren't involved in the aspect of this fraud that Mr. Renoble was. So those were not facts that would have come out or been brought to Judge Kendall's attention.
Conspiracy, isn't it?
It was a fraud scheme, yes, Judge. But quite honestly, we don't know anything more than that. And all we know is we know the prosecutor didn't say, Judge, we have this information and that information to support this position. It's, I believe so.
Do you think procedurally a defense lawyer is, or the government, I'll put it on the government, is obligated to say, here are the characteristics of a fraud where there wasn't an abuse of trust or where sophisticated means weren't? Do you have to create the comparator, or do we impute that to the district court judge, that she knows that this is something more, this is an abuse of trust position, or this is sophisticated means and therefore entitled to this enhancement? Can't we assume that the district court, a well-seasoned, able, diligent district court judge, has a sense of what makes it the plus?
I think the problem with that, especially in the sophisticated means enhancement, is the very language of the guideline says it's got to be more than the typical fraud of that kind. I don't think that you can let the government have the burden of establishing the applicability of a guideline enhancement where they have the burden to prove it by a preponderance of the evidence, to say to them, no, you don't have, because the judge might know what a typical fraud of this kind is, you're relieved of that burden. I don't think that that's the law. I think the law is that it is the government's burden to present evidence, as they did in the Whalen case, to establish the applicability of it. And I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you.
How are you, Ms. Greenwald?
Fine, Your Honor. Your Honor, the evidence was sufficient, more than sufficient, for this court to find that the district court was not clearly erroneous, which is the standard on appeal, in finding both sophisticated means and abuse of trust. And I'd like to begin by correcting what I think is a misunderstanding by Mr. Carlson as to what the evidence was on the record. While it is true at the time of his guilty plea, the defendant disputed the facts as articulated by the government in its version of the offense, with the exception of the defendant's getting the letter from the accountant. At sentencing, there was a sentencing hearing in this case. Because the defendant had disputed facts beyond getting the accountant letter, the government actually put on three witnesses, including the straw purchaser in the offense of conviction, as well as the real estate person who provided a fake letter of apartment rental income in the relevant conduct situation, as well as the case agent who testified as to statements given with respect to the underlying offense. And the government also included, and is part of the record now, all the underlying documents and contracts and false statements that were submitted both in the offense of conviction and in the relevant conduct, as well as a 302 regarding some of the participants in the underlying conduct and the offense of and the relevant conduct. And in addition to all that, in face of all that evidence, there was a sentencing hearing at which these witnesses testified, and then several days later they appeared for sentencing. And defense counsel, other than Mr. Carlson, at that sentencing, along with the defendant himself, then said, we now admit to relevant conduct as represented by the government. We now admit to the crime of conviction as represented by the government. And I would direct the court's attention, as we do in our brief, to pages 89 through 92 and page 97 of that sentencing transcript on January 23rd, where those admissions are made. And in particular, at the time when the district court is going to rule on acceptance of responsibility, the court indicated its concern about the position that the defendant had taken at both his guilty plea and at the prior hearing with respect to his admissions as to all this conduct, including the conduct underlying the offense of conviction as well as relevant conduct. And it's at that time defense counsel again repeats, we agree with everything the government's maintaining. Now, we object to an abuse of trust and we object to sophisticated means, but there was no more debate over the facts as represented by the government and, in fact, proven at the sentencing hearing. So I would say this case has overwhelming evidence, not only by admissions but by actual testimony, as to what the underlying facts were. Now, I would add that when we get to the facts that are of particular relevance to the abuse of trust and the clearly erroneous and the sophisticated means, I don't think there is any contest. There is no contest, as you were pointing out in your questions, Your Honor, of defense counsel, that he was an employee of the victim, that he was receiving his annual income, as admitted by him to the probation officer in the PSR, ranged from $100,000 to $140,000 during most of the...
Is fraud different from a typical fraud of this kind? How do you commit mortgage fraud, you know, without creating a lot of... false supporting documents. Even the probation office thought this was quite typical, and they see them all.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And here's what I'd like to first of all, the language of the provision at issue does not talk about a typical offense of conviction. The language in the sentencing guideline provides that finding that the offense involved the use of sophisticated means. This court's case law says one way you can show that is by looking at a typical offense. And there's nothing in the case law of this court that requires the government to put on evidence of what is or is not a typical offense. Nor is there a requirement in the case law. Well, actually, what the case law does provide is that it doesn't have to be much more intricate than a typical offense. That's the United States versus Robinson. And it doesn't have to go far beyond. And in this case, the district court judge, looking at this offense of conviction, had before her facts that included numerous participants, including not only a straw purchaser, not only an outside bank representative, an outside realtor, but an insider. Because the defendant himself was a loan officer for this company. This wasn't a fraud where they just went and created all this fake documents. They also recruited an insider. And that insider then on his own went and got another false document, that of a tax accountant. All of that made this case much more sophisticated than a run-of-the-mill fraud in Judge Kendall, in the district court's position. And I would also remind the court, as I'm sure you're well aware, that the standard here is clearly erroneous. You know, so it's whether this court is left with the conviction that there's been some kind of incredible mistake here made. And the evidence should not leave the court with that position. It's not a question of whether another court might have come to another conclusion, but whether this court was clearly erroneous in looking at the whole scheme. And in this context, all the documents involved, all the false players, all the coordination that's required, including the recruitment of an insider, made this sophisticated here. And I would add, this defendant, in his guilty plea, which was accepted correctly by the district court, admitted only that his false participation was bringing in the letter of the false letter to underline the document. That would have been enough to commit this crime. Submitting false documents, which is common, happens in these kind of cases. But for it to be this elaborate and these many participants in recruiting an insider and a banker and a tax accountant makes it out of the ordinary, makes it more sophisticated. And the cases that we cite in a brief support that by analogy to those factual situations. So unless the court has any other questions, we'd ask that you affirm this sentence, which in fact was 5 months below the minimum level of the advisory guideline range, and find that the district court was not clearly erroneous in finding sophisticated means as well as an abuse of trust.
Could I ask you a question about the final sentence? I didn't look at the sentencing guideline table, but if one of these enhancements hadn't been given, if the guideline range had been 2 down, given the fact that the district court varied, would the sentence have been within that range?
If one of them had. If both of them had, I believe it's a little lower. But if one of them had, then I think the 36 months is somewhere in the middle. But the government would agree with the defendant that if you reverse on these, that we could not represent. There's nothing in the record where the district court indicated that if she was wrong on any of these, she would have given the same sentence.
Yeah. Fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Carlson, do you have anything to add?
Unless the panel has any questions, I have nothing to add.
I don't?
No. Thank you. Mr. Carlson, you have the thanks of the court.